The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, Continued.
Cassette 1, Side 2.
On the walls of the waiting room, messages had been scratched with nails and scrawled in pencil. I got execution. I got 25. I got a tenner. They didn't clean off these graffiti. They served an educational purpose. Be scared. Bow down. Don't think that you can change anything by your behavior. Even if you were to speak in your own defense with the eloquence of Demosthenes, in a hall empty except for a handful of interrogators, like Olga Sliudsberg in 1936 at the Supreme Court, it would not help you in the slightest. All you could do would be to increase your sentence from 10 years to execution. For instance, if you were to shout, "You are fascists! I am ashamed to have been a member of your party for several years!" Nikolai Semyonovich Daskal did it in 1937 at the Special Collegium of the Azov Black Sea province at Maikop, presided over by Kholik. In that situation, what they did was fabricate a new case and do you in once and for all. Chavdarov has described an incident in which the accused suddenly repudiated at their trial all the false testimony they had given during their interrogation. And what happened? If there was any hesitation while glances were exchanged, it lasted no more than a few seconds. The prosecutor asked for a recess without explaining why. The interrogators and their tough boy helpers dashed in from the interrogation prison. All the prisoners, distributed among separate boxes, were given a good beating all over again and promised another after the next recess. The recess came to an end. Once again, the judges questioned all of them, and this time they all confessed. Alexander Grigorievich Karetnikov, the director of the Textile Research Institute, provided an example of outstanding astuteness. Just before the session of the military collegium of the Supreme Court was to begin, he sent word through the guard that he wanted to give supplementary testimony. This, of course, provoked curiosity. He was received by the prosecutor. Karetnikov displayed his infected collarbone, broken by the interrogator who had struck him with a stool, and declared, "I signed everything under torture." By this time, the prosecutor was cursing himself for having been so greedy to get supplementary testimony. But it was too late. Each of them is fearless only as long as he is an anonymous cog in the whole machine. But just as soon as the responsibility has become personalized, individualized, concentrated on him, just as soon as the searchlight is on him, he grows pale and realizes that he is nothing and can slip on any chance banana peel. So Karetnikov caught the prosecutor, and the latter was unwilling to suppress the whole business. The session of the military collegium began, and Karetnikov repeated his statement in front of them. Now there was a case in which the military collegium went out and rarely conferred. But the only verdict they could have brought in was acquittal, which would have meant releasing Karetnikov on the spot. Therefore, they brought in no verdict at all. As if nothing at all had happened, they took Karetnikov back to prison, treated his collarbone, and kept him another 3 months. A very polite new interrogator entered the case, who wrote out a new warrant for Karetnikov's arrest. If the collegium had not twisted things, he might at least have spent those 3 months as a free man. The interrogator asked the same questions as the first interrogator. Karetnikov, sensing freedom in the offing, conducted himself staunchly and refused to admit any guilt whatsoever. And what happened next? He got 8 years from an OSO. This example shows well enough the possibilities available to the prisoner and the possibilities available to the OSO. It was the poet Derzhavin who wrote, "A partial court is worse than banditry. Judges are enemies, there sleeps the law. In front of you, the citizen's neck lies stretched out, quiet and without defense." But it was a rare thing for such accidents to take place in the military collegium of the Supreme Court. For that matter, it was in general rare for it to rub clear its clouded eyes and take a look at any individual little tin soldier of a prisoner. In 1937, A.D.R., an electrical engineer, was taken up to the fourth floor, running upstairs with a convoy guard on either side of him. In all probability, the elevator was working, but there were so many prisoners pouring in and out that the officials and employees would not have been able to use the elevator if the prisoners had been permitted to. Meeting a convicted prisoner who had just left, they dashed into the court. The military collegium was in such a hurry, they hadn't sat down yet, and all three members remained standing. Catching his breath with difficulty, for he had been weakened by his long interrogation, R blurted out his full name. They muttered something, exchanged glances, and Ulrich, the very same, no less, proclaimed, 20 years! And they dragged R out at a gallop, and at a gallop dragged in the next prisoner. It was all like a dream. In February 1963, I, too, got to climb those stairs, but I was courteously accompanied by a colonel, who was also a Communist Party organizer. And in that room with the circular colonnade, in which, they say, the plenary sessions of the Supreme Court of the USSR meet, with an enormous horseshoe-like table that had another round table inside it and 7 antique chairs, 70 officials of the military collegium heard me out, that same military collegium which once sentenced Karetnikov and R and others, and so on and so forth. And I said to them, what a remarkable day this is. Although I was first sentenced to camp and then to eternal exile, I never before saw a single judge face to face, and now I see all of you assembled here together. And they, rubbing their eyes open for the first time, saw a living Zek. But it turned out that it had not been they. Yes, they said it had not been they. They assured me that those others were no longer present. Some had retired honorably on pensions. A few had been removed. Ulrich, the outstanding executioner of all, had been removed, it turned out, back in Stalin's time in 1950. For, believe it or not, leniency. Some of them, there were only a few of these, had even been tried under Khrushchev, and in their role as defendants, they had threatened, today you are trying us, tomorrow we will try you. Watch out. But like all the starts made under Khrushchev, this effort too, which had been very active at first, was soon abandoned. He dropped it before it got far enough to produce an irreversible change, which meant that things were left where they had been. On that occasion, several veterans of the bench, all speaking up at the same time, gave voice to their recollections, unwittingly providing me with material for this chapter. Oh, if only they had undertaken to remember and to publish. But the years pass, another 5 have gone by, and it has not become any brighter or lighter. They recalled how certain judges, at conferences of their judicial colleagues, took pride when they spoke from the rostrum of having succeeded in not applying Article 51 of the Criminal Code, which specifies those circumstances that extenuate guilt, and thus had succeeded in handing down sentences of 25 years instead of 10, and how the courts had been humiliatingly subservient to the organs. A certain judge was trying a case. A Soviet citizen who had returned from the United States had made the slanderous statement that there were good automobile roads in America, and nothing else. That was all there was to the case. The judge ventured to send the case back for further investigation for the purpose of getting genuine anti-Soviet materials. In other words, so that the accused could be beaten and tortured. But his praiseworthy intention wasn't taken into account. The angry answer came back, "You mean you don't trust our organs?" And, in the upshot, the judge was exiled to the post of secretary of a military tribunal on Sakhalin. Under Khrushchev, reproof was not so severe. Judges who made mistakes were sent, where do you think, to work as lawyers. Izvestia, June the 9th, 1964. This throws an interesting light on views of legal defense. In 1918, V.I. Lenin demanded that judges who handed down sentences that were too lenient be excluded from the party. The prosecutor's office was just as subservient to the organs. When in 1942, Ryomin's flagrant abuses in the counterintelligence section of the Northern Fleet became known, the prosecutor's office did not dare interfere on its own, but only reported respectfully to Abakumov that his boys were acting up. Abakumov had good reason to consider the organs the salt of the earth. This was the occasion when he called in Ryomin and promoted him to his own eventual undoing. There just wasn't enough time that February day, or they would have told me 10 times as much as they did. But this, too, provides food for thought. If both the courts and the prosecutor's office were simply pawns of the Minister of State Security, then maybe there isn't any need for a separate chapter to describe them. They vied with each other in telling me things, and I kept looking around me in astonishment. There were people, real people. They were smiling. They were explaining that their intentions were of the best. Well, and what if things turn full circle, and it is once again up to them to try me? Maybe even in that very hall. And they were showing me the main hall. Well, so they will convict me. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? The people or the system? For several centuries we had a proverb, don't fear the law, fear the judge. But in my opinion, the law has outstripped people, and people have lagged behind in cruelty. It is time to reverse the proverb. Don't fear the judge, fear the law. Abakumov's kind of law, of course. They stepped onto the rostrum and talked about Ivan Denisovich. They said happily that the book had eased their consciences. That's what they said. They admitted that the picture I painted was decidedly on the bright side, that every one of them knew of camps worse than that. Ah, so they did know. Of the 70 people seated around that horseshoe, several turned out to be knowledgeable in literature, even to be readers of Novy Mir. They were eager for reform. They spoke forcefully about our social ulcers, about our neglect of our rural areas. And I sat there and thought, if the first tiny droplet of truth has exploded like a psychological bomb, what then will happen in our country when whole waterfalls of truth burst forth? And they will burst forth. It has to happen. Chapter 8. The Law as a Child. We forget everything. What we remember is not what actually happened, not history, but merely that hackneyed, dotted line they have chosen to drive into our memories by incessant hammering. I do not know whether this is a trait common to all mankind, but it is certainly a trait of our people, and it is a vexing one. It may have its source in goodness, but it is vexing nonetheless. It makes us an easy prey for liars. Therefore, if they demand that we forget even the public trials, we forget them. The proceedings were open and were reported in our newspapers, but they didn't drill a hole in our brains to make us remember, and so we've forgotten them. Only things repeated on the radio day after day drill holes in the brain. I am not even talking about young people, since they, of course, know nothing of all this, but about people who were alive at the time of those trials. Ask any middle-aged person to enumerate the highly publicized open trials. He will remember those of Bukharin and Zinoviev, and knitting his brow, that of the Promparty, too. And that's all. There were no other public trials. Yet in actual fact they began right after the October Revolution. In 1918, quantities of them were taking place in many different tribunals. They were taking place before there were either laws or codes, when the judges had to be guided solely by the requirements of the revolutionary workers' and peasants' power. At the same time, they were regarded as blazing their own trail of bold legality. Their detailed history will some day be written by someone, and it's not for us even to attempt to include it in our present investigation. However, we cannot do without a brief review. It is our duty, anyway, to probe some of the charred ruins which go all the way back to that gentle, misty, rose-coloured dawn. In those dynamic years, the sabres of war were not rusting in their scabbards, nor did the executioner's revolvers have time to grow cold in their holsters. Only later on did the custom develop of hiding executions in cellars under cover of night, and of shooting the victims in the back of the head. In 1918, the famous Ryazan Chekist Stelmach had those sentenced to death shot in the courtyard during the day, so that prisoners awaiting execution could watch from the prison windows. There was an official term current then, extrajudicial reprisal. Not because there weren't any courts at the time, but because there was the Cheka. This fledgling whose beak had not yet hardened was warmed and encouraged by Trotsky. Terror is a powerful means of policy, and one would have to be a hypocrite not to understand this. And Zinoviev rejoiced too, not yet foreseeing his own end. The letters GPU, like the letters VCHK, are the most popular in the world. Because it was more efficient. Certainly there were courts, and they tried and convicted and executed people, but we need to remember that parallel to them, and independently of them,
extrajudicial reprisal went on at the same time. How can one depict its scale? M. Latsis, in his popular review of the Chequers' activity, gives us material for only a year and a half, 1918 and half of 1919, and for only 20 provinces of central Russia. The figures presented here are far from complete. In part, perhaps, out of modesty. Those shot by the Cheka, that is, without trial, bypassing the courts, numbered 8,389 persons. 8,389. Counter-revolutionary organizations uncovered 412, a fantastic figure in view of our inadequate capacity for organization throughout our history, and also the general isolation of individuals in those years and the general psychological depression. The total of those arrested, 87,000. And this figure smells of understatement. What comparison is available for purposes of evaluation? In 1907, a group of leftist leaders published a collection of essays entitled Against Capital Punishment, in which are listed by name all those sentenced to death in Tsarist Russia from 1826 to 1906. The editors qualify their findings with the statement that there were some additional victims whose names remain unknown and that the list is incomplete. However, it is certainly not so incomplete as Latsis's materials compiled during the Civil War. The list totals 1,397, from which 233 persons have to be deducted because their death sentences were commuted, as do an additional 270 who were sentenced in absentia and never caught, for the most part Polish rebels who had fled to the West. That leaves 894, a figure covering 80 years, which is not even close to Latsis's total for only 1.5 years, and not including all the provinces of Russia either. True, the editors of the collection cite another presumed statistic of 1,310 for those sentenced to death, although perhaps not executed, in 1906 alone, and a total of 3,419 for 1826 through 1906. But this, mind you, was right in the midst of the notorious Stolypin reaction, a period for which an additional figure is available, 950 executions over a period of 6 months. In fact, the Stolypin military field tribunals were in existence for 6 months, all told. It sounds awful, and yet it does not make much of an impression on our hardened nerves, even if we multiply by three this figure of 950 for 6 months, in order to compare it with the Latsis figure for 18 months in the post-revolutionary period. We still come up with the fact that the terror after the revolution was at least 3 times more intense than Stolypin's. And that was for just 20 provinces and excluded courts and tribunals. And from November 1917 on, the courts acted on their own, despite all the difficulties at the time. Guiding principles of the criminal law of the RSFSR were issued for their use in 1919. We have not read this work, could not obtain it, and know only that it included imprisonment for an indefinite term, in other words, pending a special order. The courts were of three kinds, the People's Courts, the Circuit Courts, and the Revolutionary Tribunals, the Rev Tribunals. The People's Courts handled ordinary misdemeanors and non-political criminal cases. They were not empowered to impose death sentences, and, laughable as it seems, the People's Court could not, in fact, impose sentences exceeding 2 years. Up to July 1918, the heritage of the left SRs still endured in our judicial proceedings. Only by special intervention of the government, and only individually, were impermissibly lenient sentences raised to 20 years. From July 1918 on, the People's Courts were given the right to hand down sentences of up to 5 years. And in 1922, when all threats of war had died down, the People's Courts got the right to impose sentences of up to 10 years, and lost the right to sentence anyone to less than 6 months. From the beginning, the Circuit Courts and the Rev Tribunals had the power to impose the death sentence, but they lost it for a brief period, the Circuit Courts in 1920 and the Rev Tribunals in 1921. There were many tiny ups and downs in this period, which only a historian pursuing all the details of those years would be able to trace. Perhaps that historian will seek out the documents and unroll for us the scroll of tribunal sentences and also the statistics, though probably not, Whatever time and events failed to destroy was destroyed by persons interested in having such material disappear. We know only that the Rev tribunals were not asleep. They were handing down sentences right and left. And we know, too, that every time a city was captured during the Civil War, the event was marked not only by gun smoke in the courtyards of the Cheka, but also by sleepless sessions of the tribunal. And you did not have to be a white officer, a senator, a landowner, a monk, a cadet, an SR, or an anarchist in order to get your bullet. Soft, white, uncalloused hands alone were sufficient in those years. But one can also hazard the guess that in Izhvesk or Votkinsk, Yaroslavl or Murom, Kozlov or Tambov, the uprisings were very costly as well to those who had calloused workers' hands. And if those scrolls of both the extrajudicial executions and those by tribunal are unrolled for us someday, the most surprising thing will be the number of ordinary peasants we find on them, because there was no end to the number of peasant uprisings and revolts from 1918 to 1921, even though they did not adorn the coloured pages of the official history of the Civil War, and even though no one photographed them, and no one filmed motion pictures of those furious crowds attacking machine guns with clubs, pitchforks and axes, and later lined up for execution with their arms tied behind their backs. 10 for 1. The revolt in Zaporozhok is remembered only in Zaporozhok, the one in Pitalino only in Pitalino. We learn from Latsis the number of peasant rebellions that were suppressed during that same year and a half in 20 provinces, 344. From 1918 on, peasant revolts were already being called Kulak revolts, for how could the peasants revolt against the workers' and peasants' power? But how then could one explain that in every instance it was not just 3 peasant huts that revolted, but the whole village? Why did the masses of poor peasants not kill the insurgent kulaks with those same pitchforks and axes, instead of marching with them against the machine guns? Latsis claims, the kulaks compelled the rest of the peasants to take part in these revolts by promises, slander, and threats. But what could have been more laden with promises than the slogans of the committees of the poor? And what could have been more loaded with threats than the machine guns of the special purpose detachments, the CHON? And how many wholly random people, completely random, whose destruction inevitably accounts for half the casualties of every real shooting revolution, were caught between those millstones? Here is an eyewitness description of a session of the Ryazan Rev Tribunal, which met in 1919 to hear the case of the Tolstoyan IYE-blank-V. With the proclamation of universal and compulsory conscription into the Red Army, just 1 year after the slogans, "Down with the war, stick your bayonets in the ground, go home," 54,697 deserters were caught and sent to the front by September 1919 in Ryazan province alone. And how many others were shot on the spot as examples? Y.E.-V was not a deserter at all, but a man who simply and openly refused to enter military service because of his religious convictions. He was conscripted by main force, but in the barracks he refused to take up arms or undergo training. The enraged political commissar of the unit turned him over to the Cheka, saying, "He does not recognize the Soviet government." There was an interrogation. 3 Chekists sat behind the desk, each with a Naguan revolver in front of him. "We have seen heroes like you before. You'll be on your knees to us in a minute. Either agree to fight immediately or we'll shoot you." But Y.E.-V was firm. He couldn't fight. He was a believer in free Christianity. And his case was sent to the Rev Tribunal. It was an open session with 100 spectators in the hall. There was a polite elderly defense lawyer, the learned accuser — the term prosecutor was forbidden until 1922, was Nikolsky, another old jurist. One of the members of the Rev Tribunal, a juror, tried to elicit the views of the accused. How can you, a representative of the working people, share the opinions of the aristocrat Count Tolstoy? But the presiding judge interrupted the questioning and refused to permit it to continue. There was a quarrel. Juror: "You do not want to kill people, and you try to persuade others to refrain from killing. But the whites began the war, and you are preventing us from defending ourselves. We will send you to Kolchak, and you can preach your non-resistance there." Y-E blank V. I will go wherever you send me. Accuser. This tribunal is not supposed to concern itself with any nondescript criminal actions, but only with those which are counter-revolutionary. In view of the nature of this crime, I demand that the case be turned over to a people's court. Presiding judge. Ha! Actions! What a pettifogger you are! We are guided not by the laws, but by our revolutionary conscience. Accuser. I insist that you include my demand in the record. Defense attorney. I support the accuser. The case should be heard in an ordinary court. Presiding judge. There's an old fool for you. Where did they manage to find him? Defense attorney. I have been a practicing lawyer for 40 years, and this is the first time I have heard such an insult. Enter it in the record. Presiding judge, laughing. We'll enter it. We'll enter it. Laughter in the hall. The court exits in order to confer. The sounds of a noisy argument come from the conference room. They return with the sentence. To be shot. Loud indignation in the hall. Accuser. I protest against the sentence and will complain to the Commissariat of Justice. Defense lawyer. I join my voice to that of the accuser. Presiding judge. Clear the hall. The convoy came and led Y.E. blank B to jail, saying to him, If everyone was like you, brother, how good it would be. There would be no war, and no whites and no reds. They went back to their barracks and called a Red Army meeting. It condemned the sentence and sent a protest to Moscow. In daily expectation of death, Y.E. blank V waited for 37 days, while, from the prison window, he watched executions taking place. They commuted his sentence to 15 years of strict detention. This is an instructive example. Although revolutionary legality won a partial victory, how enormous an effort it required on the part of the presiding judge, how much disorganization, lack of discipline, lack of political consciousness there still was. The prosecution stood firmly with the defense. The convoy guard stuck their noses into something that wasn't their business in order to send off a protest. Phew! The dictatorship of the proletariat and the new kind of court were not having things easy by any means. Of course, not all the sessions were anything like so turbulent, but this wasn't the only one of its kind. How many years it would take to reveal, direct, and confirm the necessary line until the defense would stand as one with the prosecution and the court, and the accused would be in agreement with them too, and all the resolutions of the workers as well. To pursue this enterprise of many years' duration is the rewarding task of the historian. As for us, how are we to make our way through that rosy mist? Whom are we to ask about it? Those who were shot aren't talking, and neither are those who have been scattered to the four winds. Even if the defendants, and the lawyers, and the guards, and the spectators have survived, no one will allow us to seek them out. Evidently, the only help we will get is from the prosecution. In this connection, I was given by well-wishers an intact copy of a collection of speeches for the prosecution, delivered by that fierce revolutionary, the first People's Commissar of Military Affairs in the Workers' and Peasants' Government, the Commander-in-Chief, and later the organizer of the Department of Exceptional Courts of the People's Commissariat of Justice, where the personal rank of Tribune was being readied for him, until Lenin vetoed the title. Lenin, 5th edition, volume 36, page 210. The glorious accuser in the greatest trials, subsequently exposed as the ferocious enemy of the people, N.V. Krylenko. Krylenko, Za Piat Let, 1918-1922, edition 7,000 copies, prosecution speeches in the most important trials held before the Moscow and the Supreme Revolutionary Tribunals. And if, despite everything, we want to attempt a brief review of the public trials, if we are determined to try to get a feeling for the judicial atmosphere of the first post-revolutionary years, then we have to learn to read this Krylenko text. We have no other. And using it as a basis, we must try to picture to ourselves everything that is missing from it, and everything that happened in the provinces too. Of course, we would prefer to see the stenographic record of those trials, to listen to the dramatic voices from beyond the grave of those first defendants and those first lawyers, speaking at a time when no one could have foreseen in what implacable sequence all of it would be swallowed up, together with those Rev Tribunal members as well. However, as Krylenko has explained, for a whole series of technical reasons, it was inconvenient to publish the stenographic records. It was convenient only to publish his speeches for the prosecution and the sentences handed down by the tribunals, which by that time had already come to jibe completely with the demands of the accuser-prosecutor. Krylenko claims that the archives of the Moscow Rev Tribunal and the Supreme Rev Tribunal turned out, by 1922, to be far from orderly. In a whole series of cases, the stenographic records were so incomprehensible that it was necessary either to cross out entire pages or else to try to restore the text from memory. And a series of the biggest trials, including the trial which followed the revolt of the left SRs and the case of Admiral Shchastny, were conducted entirely without stenographic records. This is strange. The condemnation of the left SRs was not a trivial matter. It was, after the February and October revolutions, the third turning point in our history, signalling the transition to a one-party system in the state. Not a few of them were shot, and no stenographic record was made. And the military plot of 1919 was liquidated by the Cheka in an extrajudicial reprisal, which was further proof of its existence. In this case, more than 1,000 people were arrested altogether, and really, how could trials have been set up for them all? So just try to produce a neat, orderly report on the trials of those years. Nevertheless, we can learn the important principles involved in them. For example, the Supreme Accuser, in other words, the Prosecutor General, informs us that the All-Russian Central Executive Committee had the right to intervene in any judicial proceeding. VTSIK pardons and punishes at its own discretion without any limitation whatever. For example, a six-month sentence was changed to 10 years, and as the reader understands, it was not necessary for the entire All-Russian Central Executive Committee to assemble at a plenary meeting to this end, since its chairman, Sverdlov, for example, could correct a sentence without leaving his office. All of this, Krylenko explains, shows the superiority of our system over the false theory of the separation of powers, that is, the theory of the independence of the judiciary. True, Sverdlov also said, it is very good that the legislative and executive power are not divided by a thick wall as they are in the West. All problems can be decided quickly, especially on the phone. Krylenko formulated even more frankly and precisely the general tasks of the Soviet courts in his speeches before those tribunals, when the court was, at one and the same time, both the creator of the law, Krylenko's italics, and a political weapon, my italics. Creator of the law because for 4 years there were no codes. They had thrown out the Tsarist codes, and they had not composed their own. Don't tell me our criminal courts ought to act exclusively on the basis of existing written norms. We live in the process of revolution. A tribunal is not the kind of court in which fine points of jurisprudence and clever stratagems are to be restored. We are creating a new law and new ethical norms. And also, no matter how much is said here about the eternal law of truth, justice, etc., we know how dearly these have cost us. But if your prison terms are compared with ours, maybe it didn't cost you so dearly after all. Maybe eternal justice was somewhat more comfortable. The reason that fine points of jurisprudence are unnecessary is that there is no need to clarify whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. The concept of guilt is an old bourgeois concept which has now been uprooted. And so we have heard from Comrade Krylenko that a tribunal was not that kind of court. On another occasion, we would hear from him that a tribunal was not a court at all. A tribunal is an organ of the class struggle of the workers directed against their enemies, and must act from the point of view of the interests of the revolution, having in mind the most desirable results for the masses of workers and peasants. People are not people, but carriers of specific ideas. No matter what the individual qualities of the defendant, only one method of evaluating him is to be applied, evaluation from the point of view of class expediency. In other words, you can exist only if it's expedient for the working class, and if this expediency should require that the avenging sword should fall on the head of the defendants, then no verbal arguments can help, such as arguments by lawyers, etc. In our revolutionary court, we are guided not by articles of the law and not by the degree of extenuating circumstances. In the tribunal, we must proceed on the basis of considerations of expediency. That was the way it was in those years. People lived and breathed and then suddenly found out that their existence was inexpedient. And it must also be kept in mind that it was not what he had done that constituted the defendant's burden, but what he might do if he were not shot now. We protect ourselves not only against the past, but also against the future. Comrade Krylenko's pronouncements are clear and all-inclusive. They bring alive for us that whole period of the law in sharp relief. The clarity of autumn suddenly pierces the mists of spring and reaches us. And is it perhaps unnecessary to go further? Perhaps we aren't required to page through trial after trial. These pronouncements will be henceforth inexorably applied. Close your eyes tight for a minute and picture a tiny courtroom, not yet gilded. Earnest members of the tribunal in simple field jackets, lean, not yet fat-faced. The accusing power, as Krylenko loved to style himself, wears an unbuttoned civilian jacket with a glimpse of a sailor's striped undershirt just visible at the open throat. The supreme accuser expresses himself in this sort of language. The question of fact is interesting to me. Define concretely the aspect of the tendency. We are operating on the plane of analysis of objective truth. Sometimes, as you read, a quotation from the Latin shines out. It is true that the same quotation turns up in case after case, but after several years a different one does appear. And no wonder. He did, after all, complete the course in two faculties despite all his revolutionary running around. What attracts one to him are his frank opinions about the defendants. Professional scoundrels! And he isn't hypocritical in the least. If he didn't like the defendant's smile, he didn't hesitate to blurt out a threat, even before any sentence was imposed. And as for you and your smile, Citizeness Ivanova, we'll make you pay for it, and we'll find a way to fix it so that you never laugh again. So, shall we begin? A. The case of Ruskiye Vedomosti. In this case, one of the earliest, free speech was on trial. On March the 24th, 1918, this famous professorial newspaper published an article by Savinkov entitled En Route. They would have much preferred to arrest Savinkov himself, but he really was en route, damn it. And where was he to be found? So instead they closed down the paper and brought the elderly editor, P.V. Yegorov, to court as a defendant, insisting that he explain how he had dared to publish the article. After all, the new era was 4 months old, and it was time to get used to it. Yegorov naively defended himself by saying that the article had been written by a leading political figure whose opinion was of general interest, whether or not the editors shared it. Furthermore, he saw nothing slanderous in Savinkov's having said, "Let us not forget that Lenin, Natanson, and co. arrived in Russia via Berlin." That is, that the German authorities helped them return to the homeland. Because that, in actual fact, was what had happened. Kaiser Wilhelm's embattled Germany had helped Comrade Lenin to return. Krylenko retorted that he would not conduct a prosecution for slander. Why not? And that the newspaper was on trial for attempting to influence people's minds. And how could any newspaper dare have such a purpose? The formal charge did not include Savinkov's phrase, "One has to be criminally insane to affirm seriously that the international proletariat will come to our aid," because it still would come to our aid. For attempting to influence people's minds, the newspaper, which had been published since 1864 and had survived the most fiercely reactionary periods, those of Loris Melikov, Pobedonetsov, Stolypin, Kasso, and all the rest, was ordered closed down forever. And Yegorov, the editor, and this is a shameful thing to have to say, was given only 3 months of solitary, just as though we were in Greece or some such place. It is not so shamefully lenient, however, if one stops to think that it was only 1918, and if the old man managed to survive, he would be imprisoned again, and many more times, too. It may seem strange to us now, but it is a fact that in those thunderous years, bribes were given and taken just as tenderly as they had been from time immemorial in old Russia, and as they will be in the Soviet Union from here to eternity. Bribery was particularly rife in the judicial organs, and though we blush to say it, in the Cheka. The official histories in their red, gold-stamped bindings are silent about this, but the old folks and eyewitnesses remember that the fate of political prisoners in the first years of the revolution, as distinct from Stalinist times, often depended on bribes. They were accepted uninhibitedly, and prisoners were honestly released as a result. Although Krylenko picked out only a dozen cases for the five-year period his book covers, he reports two cases of bribery. Alas, even the Moscow Tribunal and the Supreme Tribunal squeezed their way through to perfection along a crooked path, muddied themselves in improprieties. B. The case of the three interrogators of the Moscow Rev Tribunal, April 1918. In March 1918, a speculator in gold bars named Berije was arrested. His wife tried to find a way to ransom her husband, which was the accepted thing to do. Through a series of connections, she succeeded in getting to one of the interrogators, who brought two others in with him. Meeting secretly, they demanded a bribe of 250,000 rubles, but after some bargaining, they reduced it to 60,000, half in advance. The deal was to be made through the lawyer Grin. Everything would have gone off without a fuss, as hundreds of similar deals had, and the case would have gotten into neither Krylenko's chronicle nor ours, nor even become a matter of concern to the Council of People's Commissars, had it not been that Berije's wife began to get miserly and brought Green only 15,000 as an advance payment instead of 30,000. But the main thing was that, in consequence of female fickleness, she changed her mind overnight, decided her lawyer wasn't good enough for her, and went off the next morning to find another, the attorney Yakulov. It is not stated anywhere, but it was evidently Yakulov who decided to turn in the interrogators. It is of interest that all the witnesses in this trial, beginning with the unfortunate wife, tried to give testimony helpful to the accused and to befuddle the prosecution, which would have been impossible in a political trial. Krylenko explained their conduct as the result of a narrow-minded Philistine attitude, because they felt like outsiders as far as the Rev Tribunal was concerned. And might we ourselves be so audacious as to advance the Philistine hypothesis that in the course of a year and a half the witnesses had already learned to be afraid of the dictatorship of the proletariat? After all, it took a lot of nerve to turn in the interrogators of the Rev Tribunal. What would happen to you after that? The accuser's line of argument is also of interest. After all, just a month earlier, the defendants had been his associates, his comrades in arms, his assistants. They were people who had been inalienably dedicated to the interests of the revolution, and one of them, Liszt, was even a stern accuser, capable of hurling thunder and lightning at anyone who attacked the foundations. What was he to say about them now? Where was he to look for the causes of their fall? A bribe was not enough in itself. And, of course, it is clear where he looked, in their pasts, in their biographies. Declared Krylenko, "If we look closely at this Liszt, we will find highly interesting information." This is intriguing. Was he an inveterate adventurer? No, but he was the son of a professor at Moscow University, and not an ordinary professor, but one who had survived 20 years of reaction by his indifference to political activity, and who, notwithstanding that reaction, had been accepted by Krylenko as a consultant. Was it surprising, then, that the son turned out to be a double dealer?
This book is continued on Cassette 2.